This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show. Today on the James Altucher Show.
Well, it's funny because I must have asked you a couple times in the past few months to come on the podcast, and finally our schedules clicked. But just in the past few weeks, you've been writing on Twitter these hashtag Goldman tips,
yes.
Like a comedy tip of the day.
Yeah.
And often it's a tip for any kind of art. Like it could be a writing tip. I saw someone tweet, all these are working for
yes.
me for music.
Yes.
So they're really about art and the discipline and attention one should pay to being an artist of any kind. And I feel like these tips are picking up steam. So clearly there is a book in you that's coming out, you know, bit by bit over Twitter, which is exciting
right.
to watch. Because I've been following these tips and they were fantastic. Each one has been a game-changing tip.
Oh, wow.
So we're going to talk about them. But I wanted to ask you, too, about your depression. You're grappling with this demon.
Yes.
And it wasn't like a situational thing. It was
oh, yeah.
a medical thing.
Yeah, it was chemical, yes.
And you had been hospitalized.
Yes. Yes. And depression, it's like a satanic possession. I wasn't myself for so long. And now to live as myself and be myself is so, it's exhilarating. And I'm so grateful. And everything is so much easier to do. Walking up these stairs, getting on the subway, going to the grocery store. These things that used to be monumental tasks that I would put off because they were so overwhelming are now just I don't even think twice about that. So when over the years people would come to me and say, do you want to write a book? Do you want to write a screenplay? Do you want to pitch a show? I would say, I can't do laundry.
Is that a bit, that almost sounds like
no, it's not. It's not.
So happy to have back for the third time Gary Goldman. Probably my favorite comedian in the
oh,
world.
Wow.
Gary, welcome.
That's really
once again
nice.
To the show.
That's really nice. That's important. Thank you.
No, I mean the last podcast we did, I think has become like a comedy podcast classic because we take apart
oh, yeah.
your joke,
yeah.
the abbreviated state. It's a 6-minute joke. We talk for 90 minutes like about every single word.
I recommend that when people ask me how'd you come up with that joke because it's probably the deepest I've ever gotten into it.
Is that a joke, the joke that people ask you the most?
How oh, do yes. Like? Yes. People come up to me after the show and they start the sentence by saying, I first discovered you from your, and then they try to think of the name for it and I say, the abbreviations bit. And then I say, that's my Miss American Pie.
Your magnum opus.
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
Well, there's so many things I want to talk about. In particular, you know, I want to start with some of the things we ended with the last time, where you talked about depression and you were
yeah.
about to take a break then. But, you know, I do want to ask, actually, I need to get slapped in the face.
We were talking about depression.
Let's talk about depression. So when I last saw you, you were about to move back to Boston for a little
yeah.
while.
Yeah.
You were kind of medication resistant to
yep.
clinical depression.
Yes.
And you had been for a while.
Yes.
I remember when you came on for the first podcast, it was early in the morning and that was a bad time for
oh,
you.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
you
yeah.
could barely speak. You had no
yeah.
volume in the voice. And,
right,
and,
yeah.
And then the second time I had scheduled it in the afternoon, but still things were, you were grappling with this demon.
Yes.
And it wasn't like a situational thing. It was just like, it was like a
oh, yeah.
medical thing.
Yeah, it was chemical, yes.
And you had been hospitalized.
Yes. Yes, and it's interesting because a depression has a rhythm, and it affects more than just your mood. It slows down your speech, your access to words, and also your confidence in speaking. And it's hard to make connections. My doctor said that a lot of psychiatrists refer to it as faux dementia because you get a lot of the memory and cognitive issues that you get with dementia in adult patients. So it's alarming how many things that I experienced but completely forgotten. It'll really upset my girlfriend because she'll say, "Oh, you don't remember that at all." And I said, "No, it was in the depths of the depression, and I don't remember it." And she'll have such vivid memories of certain things, and it's sad.
Well, why do you think it's? I mean, and they say that also about bipolar. That bipolar
okay.
often The initial symptoms almost can seem like early onset Alzheimer's.
Yeah.
And I wonder, what's the connection between, like, some things are somehow not moving into long-term memory? Is that because the depression gets in the way? Like, is it anxiety or is it depression?
I'm not sure. It might be a combination. My psychiatrist would probably have more specific ideas. He's even for a psychiatrist, he's an expert on these things. He's got a great reputation. His name is Dr. Richard Friedman. He writes a lot of op-eds for the New York Times, so you can find a lot of his work. But I don't know what the connection is. I just know that it's the mood thing is only part of the depression, and there are physical things. Like I remember just my girlfriend would be walking, and she's a pretty slow walker, and I couldn't keep up with her. I would keep telling her to slow down and to wait for me, and it was so sad. It looked like she was my caregiver or something. I was just shuffling around, and these small errands, like three blocks to go get my dog some food, would just exhaust me. And I'd come home and be exhausted from just three blocks and a case of dog food. So it's just the mood is terrible. That's the worst part of it. But there are the physical and the cognitive issues, and also there's no escape because you can't enjoy anything. Like I remember somebody saying, well, think of some of those things that you love to do and just do them exclusively. And the list was empty. There was nothing that I enjoyed doing: watching movies, reading, which was my thing. I used to read 50 books at least every year, and for 2 years I didn't read a single book. I couldn't get through it. I couldn't concentrate. My mind would get so overwhelmed by the words, and I would just read things over and over again, and it just was too frustrating to keep doing.
And what do you think? I mean, there's lots of causes of depression. Like,
yeah,
there's lack of serotonin, there's lack of dopamine, there's bipolar, there's situational, which might get confused with clinical.
Sure.
What do you think was triggering yours? And this is why a lot of people appear to be treatment resistant, because they don't know what kind of depression they have.
Right. Yeah, I would say that it had to have been mostly chemical, because the thing that finally gave me the ladder to climb out was a change in medication. But it was the seventh or eighth change in medication within 2.5 years.
Yeah, I've heard it takes on average 8 years for someone to find the right treatment for depression.
It's incredible. And they're saying now that there's some sort of saliva test where they can sort of narrow the
Yeah, they can do a DNA.
Yeah.
They can do a DNA test and then match you against other people who were treatment resistant, but then eventually found the right medicine.
Right.
They match your DNA to see which one it most closely matches in their database, and then they give you the same treatment that the one who matches got.
Right. Yeah, I've heard about that, but I never did that. It was just trial and error. But my doctor said, I did ask him. I said, why did you think this would finally work? And he said the two medicines I take, one is Cymbalta, the other one is Remeron. He said they attack so many aspects of a depression chemically, and he thought that this all out assault would be the answer, and it was within 2 weeks, and it gave me enough of a jumping off point where I could start to do a few of the things that had helped me in the past to sort of augment my mood. And one of them was spending time with other people, and the other one was some exercise. Not very vigorous at first, but eventually I was able to run long distances, and that became something that was crucial in
my recovery. That releases endorphins.
Yes.
That in general is an antidepressant.
Yes, absolutely.
And so why didn't he start with that? Like, is there side effects? Like, what was he worried about if he started?
I'm not sure. We had tried a couple of other things, and then at the insistence of my mother, I got a second opinion, and it was just very, very foolish. And I tried something else, and it actually made everything worse by double or triple. So
yeah, like that was, I think people, they just throw everything at you if they don't know what to do. Like, I remember one time I was suffering from depression, and they just kept literally, let's say, upping the ante until I was taking these antipsychotic drugs that would just make me sleep all day.
Yes.
They weren't helping at all.
Yes.
They were just, I would just be groggy, or I would sleep 14 hours and then be groggy the rest of the day.
Yes. I will say, though, that I think Remeron is an antipsychotic, but in the dose that I take, it's been found to be an effective antidepressant, but I don't take very much. And I think it was more the Cymbalta that was the difference maker. Yeah.
And so what did you start after 2 weeks? What did you start feeling like? Did you start like the clouds cleared, or?
Well, I don't know if you ever have this reaction to coffee, but some days it makes me feel all powerful and really confident, and I write things and I'm just energized. And for 2 years I would drink coffee and nothing would happen. Nothing would happen. I wouldn't get anything out of it. And then I stopped drinking coffee. And then one day I had a cup of coffee and I felt like a god. And I talked to my doctor about it, and he said that was a really good sign that this was having some effect on you. And also I had exercised extensively during the 2 years. I eventually gave up because it was too difficult, but I had exercised a lot and got nothing out of it. And then I started exercising again, and I would notice an improvement in my mood within 15 to 18 minutes of starting the exercise, and then it would carry over after the exercise, and it was really helpful. So it was the best way I can put it is the medicine just gave me a more normal starting place for my mood, rather than being just underwater all the time.
And you know, when you moved from New York to Boston,
yeah,
and then I remember you said you were gonna work even at a summer camp.
Yeah, I did that. Yeah.
And so you were, it seemed like briefly you were just gonna take a break from comedy even.
I'm sure
you did some clubs in
Boston. I was going to stop doing comedy because I was starting to get too anxious, and it showed on stage. It was the first time it had ever showed on stage, because I did a Colbert in 2016, I think, or maybe 2017,
I think, was the, you talk about depression in the 2017.
Yes, but I never mentioned depression.
Right,
yeah.
You talk about please be AM, please be AM.
Yes.
You know, when you wake up.
Oh my gosh, yes. Yes, so.
It was 1 p.m.
Yes.
I missed a whole M.
Yes, wow. But the gist of that was that the fork prints were evidence of a life in chaos, but now I would say that fork prints are symptoms of clinical depression. Fork prints and ice cream, rather.
What's fork prints?
Fork prints. Fork.
Oh,
if you're eating
prints.
Ice cream with a fork, your life is in chaos. Yeah. So I wasn't explicit about suffering from depression. I wasn't comfortable with that on late night television. And so you wouldn't even know that I was depressed unless you knew me from that performance. But I slept up until it was time to get dressed, and then I went home and slept after that and was devastated by the performance, and I was just a wreck.
Even though I'm sure people were telling you the performance was great.
Yes.
You wouldn't believe it.
Right. But later that year, it got to the point where, no, it's so obvious that you're in crisis and you're shaking on stage. You're biting your lip and it's bleeding while you're on stage, and that's...
On that set?
No.
Oh, no, later.
Later,
okay.
Yeah, later that year. And you need to take a break from this. And our mutual friend, Amy Koppelman, said, even if you just have to have a regular job for the rest of your life, because this is killing you. And that was my plan when I went back to Boston, was to try to transition to another career. I had some dates on my calendar that I had to fulfill, because the money was very good and it would help cushion my fall. But I was in a major transition career wise at 45 or 46 or whatever it was.
And so like you what about like relationship wise? Like you were and are in a relationship. She was supportive of the move, but did you have faith that you guys would remain together? Like, well, I imagine that everything must have been in chaos at this point.
Yeah, I must say that I was hoping that she would just say, I can't take this anymore and move on, because I felt so guilty about what I was not giving her as far as partnership and And yet she stuck by. She went to every doctor's appointment and visited me in the hospital every day. And she's really the MVP of my life over the past few years. Her loyalty and devotion was unshakable. I mean, yeah.
Can I ask why during this period did you have to go be hospitalized?
Well, I'm making a new special and documentary associated with it. And so I don't want to get too far into sort of the mechanics of the hospitalization, because I would rather that be a surprise to people. So I won't go into that. But I will say that my girlfriend brought together our friend Amy and my best friend from childhood, and they had a discussion with me about what I should do, and it was, they didn't call it an intervention, but that's how it turned out, that I went into the hospital after that conversation. Yeah.
So when the treatment started kicking in, you know, and did you start to feel like, okay, I'm gonna try getting back into comedy? Like, what was your first think? When did the compass start to move back towards true north?
Well, I think the interesting thing was that I was living in Boston, and there was a club in Harvard Square in Cambridge that I had that sort of carte blanche, that they would let me close every show that they had. So I would just go on at the end for between 15 minutes and a half hour, whatever they had left, before they had to break down the room. And I was so messed up that it would have been very strange had I not acknowledged what was going on. So I had to talk about it in order to do comedy. So that was very helpful. It was sort of a necessity type situation. And that was the first time I started being very candid about my depression. So I was doing a little bit of stand up, but I was shaking the whole time, and I would watch the videos. I have the videos, and I would be making faces that looked like I was in excruciating pain, and there were times where it was really painful to watch and to experience. And then when I started to feel better, okay, so
like when you would go and do those 15 or 30 minutes and you were starting to reveal about the depression,
yeah,
were you in advance trying to write a little about it and throw in some punchlines, or were you just going up there and figuring your years of work and stage time and presence would be able to make whatever you were saying funny?
Well, I always write things down, and I always ruminate on ideas. So I was preparing all the time, and so, but I will say that, oh man, from that, I wrote those 5 minutes for the Colbert show. I don't know when that happened. And then for more than a year, I wrote and wrote and couldn't come up with anything that was worth putting on television or really worth repeating on stage. I was just going up there with blanks night after night, and I had good enough stuff from my archives that I could do the job, but nothing new was coming out. And once I started to feel better and be myself, then the floodgates opened up. So I think this is important. I moved back to my mom's June 22nd of 2017, and between then and the following summer, I wrote like 90 new minutes, which I've never had that type of creative run in my life. I've written 45, I've written an hour, but not even an hour, but 90 minutes in a year is impressive.
Well, I think in the middle of that, it was either November or early December, I saw you of 2017, I saw you at the Comedy Cellar.
Yeah.
And the set you did, I thought was so incredible.
It
was
like, thanks.
You know, it was so funny. There was a very good lineup. and I think you were closing, and your pacing was just so calm and confident, and you were like saying these esoteric quotes from, you know, to kind of go along from famous people, you know, to go along with the jokes, and just everything was like, it was like almost a different style of humor, I felt.
Yeah,
you know,
probably.
That night was really good comics too, yeah, up there.
Yeah. Yeah, that's probably the case. I definitely have reached, I feel, a new level in my work. Yeah. And I think part of it was sort of the how exhilarating it was to have this muscle back. It's sort of like if you had broken your leg and not been able to walk for a year, and then all of a sudden, after doing a lot of therapy, physical therapy, you went out and played basketball, and then you would want to stay after and dunk and dunk and dunk. And that's how what I feel I'm doing now with my comedy. I can't wait to get on stage every night. And for a time I dreaded it, and it was impossible for me to perform. I don't know if this is a good analogy, but the best analogy I can use these days is that the depression, it's like a satanic possession. I wasn't myself for so long, and now to live as myself and be as myself is so exhilarating, and I'm so grateful, and everything is so much easier to do. Walking up these stairs, getting on the subway, going to the grocery store, these things that used to be monumental tasks that I would put off because they were so overwhelming are now just I don't even think twice about that. So when over the years people would come to me and say, do you want to write a book? Do you want to write a screenplay? Do you want to pitch a show? I would say, I can't do laundry.
Is that a bit, that almost sounds like
no, it's not. It's not. I couldn't even do laundry. So the idea of me writing a book, it's just, yes, I'm very flattered that you think I have that in me, but I may, but my tools are ruined. Yeah.
Well, it's funny because so I must have asked you a couple times in the past few months to come on the podcast, and finally our schedules clicked. But just in the past few weeks, you've been writing on Twitter these hashtag Goleman tips,
yes,
like a comedy tip of the day.
Yeah.
And often it's a tip for any kind of art. Like, it could be a writing tip. I saw someone tweet, these are working for,
yes,
me for music.
Yes.
So they're really about art and the discipline and work and attention one should pay to being an artist of any kind. And I feel like these tips are picking up steam. So clearly there is a book in you that's coming out, you know, bit by bit over Twitter, which is exciting,
right,
to watch, because I've been following these tips. I realized maybe by day four, oh, this is going to be a regular thing. And they were fantastic. Now we're on day 22.
Yeah.
So, and each one has been a game-changing tip.
Oh, wow.
So we're gonna talk about them in a little bit, but I wanted to ask you too about, you know, you look at when, you know, let's say your depression has a line in the sand, and so there's, uh-huh, post-depression, or post-coming out of depression, pre-coming out of depression. The pre, a lot of your written jokes, you know, the jokes that we see and know you by,
yeah,
all your famous hilarious jokes, including abbreviated states or,
right,
role play or any,
yes,
of these things, they're made up, right? They're,
yes,
they're fiction.
Yes.
And there's a difference between fictional jokes, which still are just as funny and meaningful and maybe even more difficult to write than jokes that kind of come out of your real life.
Yeah.
And I've heard arguments on both sides. Like, some people, you know, live and die by writing fictional jokes and think those are great.
Yeah.
And other people are a little bit more observational. They see what happens to them that day. They make fun of it on stage,
right,
later,
yeah,
later that day, and then they,
sure,
work out the material.
Yes.
And how do you know, you've obviously been going through this transformation, because now for the first time ever, you've been talking about what's been going on in your life as opposed to purely making it up. But it does seem like purely making it up, I'm not saying better or worse, but more difficult in some way. Like, the more parts of the imagination have to click in.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, right now you were just telling me a story and it almost sounded like a bit.
Right.
But it was a story about what was happening to you.
Yes.
Whereas to make up the abbreviated states, and again, I'm not saying better or worse. I prefer the real, the truth stuff.
Sure.
But there's something amazing, too, about the made-up material, like completely fictional material.
Yeah, I love both. So I can't think of there. Yeah, there are silly things. To me, the made up is the silly. I love the silly. So there's some silliness.
So it's like you're sitting back and you're thinking,
yes,
who the hell named these, abbreviated these states?
Yes.
And you have a thought and it just, and you figure something in you from based on your experience says, you know, I can maybe go deeper on that and make a joke.
Well, it was, and this is the one that I get asked the most about when we've gone in depth, and I don't know if I said that then, but it was, the premise was most of these states start with the same first two letters, and there was probably a time in comedy where you could say, did you ever notice a lot of the states start with the same first two letters? I mean, New England, New York and New Jersey or whatever it would be, and the people would laugh and say, I never noticed that. But now it's just like, yeah, you got to go a little bit deeper than that. And there's a Bob Newhart influence in it too, where he created a fake thing with Abraham Lincoln. So it's just, I really just kind of rewrote that when I think about it, not intentionally or consciously or explicitly, but it's that type of style where you're making up something that didn't happen to serve a story that you could never really figure out. Well, there probably is a story of how they abbreviated the states, but the people weren't as charming. So,
or a lack of charm.
Yeah,
But like you mentioned in one of your recent tweets, something I didn't know is that you kind of started working on that joke in 1996.
Oh yeah.
And the contractor part came like 20 years later.
Oh yes.
So, but that's interesting though. Like and because this will get into one of the Goldman tips.
The contractor came out like near the end, because in 2006 I have some notes where he's known as the abbreviator. And then that just isn't as fun.
So, but in terms of like kind of mining funny material for greater and greater depths, like maybe the original, I don't know what it was in 1996, but maybe you were just had some punchline around the fact that people in the post office must be really confused or something. I don't know.
I remember what it was the first time I did it at like a high school. I said, I think I had the idea that these men came together and they said, Alaska, Alabama, I think we might have used that one before. And then they said, let's just move on. And in the next one, the guy's response to the fact that they both started with the same first two letters was, oh shit. And then I just broke down into them swearing at each other, because that's all I really knew how to write. I was only a few years in. And then the crazy thing with that is that documentaries and film had to change to be about small things so that you could believe that they could make a documentary about something so absurd. And that was, I think I mentioned in the interview, that was just an inspiration one night at a club. I was talking about one documentary and I said, but what about this documentary? And then I just made it up and that was the sort of the final push.
Well, it was a good way to, I think in the set you start off, I'm here to recommend a documentary,
yes,
and then I'm going.
Yes.
But it was a good kind of umbrella.
But that's ahead of my time, because now everybody wants to tell you about this great documentary they just saw.
Because now documentaries are better.
Yes, they're better and they're ubiquitous. Yeah.
But it was an interesting structure in that, and then we'll get into the Goldman tips and some other stuff. But it was an interesting structure in that you have this umbrella about this documentary, but you fit in to 5 minutes, essentially like 30 jokes and punchlines.
Oh yeah.
And it was after we did our podcast, I started thinking for myself, just in my meager, babyish stand-up experience, I started thinking, how can I take, let's say, all the jokes I try to piece together and remember and find an umbrella-like structure like that? And it is interesting to sort of weave everything through to a complete story. Because you had like the omelet station and you know, all these
like
things that could have been separate jokes.
One of the tips was to cannibalize your act. So I had years ago written this thing about this really surly omelet chef in St. Thomas, And I would throw it out there every once in a while, and nobody really laughed at it. And then I realized that I needed a discussion to cut away from the Alabama before we got to Alaska, to make the audience forget what we were talking about. And I said, well, just try the omelet routine. And then I also had a joke about how the hotel I was staying at stopped serving breakfast at 9 a.m. And I always feel, as a comedian, I do not want to write jokes about things that other comedians are writing about. And comedians do a lot of hotel stuff. There's like an entire franchise of comedians doing jokes about the keys losing their magnetism in your pocket or whatever. I've seen a dozen different comedians do it. So I'm like, I'm not going to do a hotel joke. But I snuck in a hotel joke in this other joke, knowing that people won't say, well, it's just a hotel joke.
Because there's a certain... because
it's hidden.
There's also a certain absurdism to them having this discussion in the middle of a faux documentary about right. the States.
Right.
So like, why? Like, I'm watching a documentary right. about the States. Why are they getting into this intense discussion yes. about whether the omelet chef is happy or not?
But the more absurd it is, the funnier it is. And the more specific it is, the more absurd it is, right?
But the segue itself is absurd. Like, yes. if you had just told the joke, that's funny.
Yeah.
But the segue away from...
oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
That,
yeah.
that itself yeah. is funny.
Yeah. But I've seen other comedians do that. I didn't make that up. Yeah.
But still, I just appreciated the, you know, I appreciated the fact that no matter where a joke is, there's usually, I mean, you even give a tip, I'm trying to remember the exact words, but you basically say, put spaces between the lines and try
oh,
to
yeah,
fill
yeah,
in
yeah.
those blanks.
Yeah.
Because there's always further depths you can mine
yeah,
a piece of material.
There's so many times where you say something and to me it's instinctual, and it may not have always been, but there will be things that I'll say. So just for example, say my I grew up and I was a very strange kid. And then you don't follow up on that. And that's screaming to say, how are you strange? What strange things did you do? And then over the years, I've written 100 things about weird things I did as a kid. And then I just keep trying them out. And some of them are too strange. Some of them aren't strange enough. And then you find one that's the right fit. And it feels, it's exhilarating. I can't tell you how exhilarating it has been to get that feedback again off of new jokes, because I was missing it for years. Yeah.
I remember before we started the last podcast where I described to you what we were going to do,
yeah.
there was almost like a look of panic in your face. Like,
oh, yeah.
And you were like, because I think I hit a nerve a little bit, like, oh, no, that's like the last great joke I'll
tell.
Oh,
yeah, I'll never write another good joke again. So, and I've had that feeling before, and I've gone 3 months. This time it was over 2 years, and it was... it's interesting because I was going mad, but that was even more maddening. Yeah.
And so, you know, one of the Goldman tips is, which you alluded to earlier, is go back to your old jokes.
Yeah.
And now that you have more experience,
yes.
you can see how they fit into your current set. You could, they've evolved too with you, and see how they evolve. So that's very interesting advice. And
yeah.
that's essentially what you did with the omelet station and the abbreviated states.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Have you seen it more recently?
Well, I'm trying to think of the joke that I was going through an old notebook just in preparation for that tip, and I found something where I said, "Oh my gosh, you could really have fun with that now," and it really made me so happy, because I was not just throwing out this thing that had worked once. It was something that I could keep coming back to, and I have boxes and boxes of composition books and notepads, and they're my greatest asset, I think.
Yeah. Do you write every day?
Yes. I will say, you don't have to write all day, but you do have to write every day.
Like one of your tips is set a timer for like 19
yes.
minutes.
Oh my gosh,
and,
yes.
And just keep writing until the 19 minutes are over. Now, are yes. you writing anything or are you trying to write premise punchline?
Well, lately I'm working on a Conan O'Brien appearance for January 31st. So what I've been doing is writing out the set and then taking each joke and figuring out exactly what I want to say and then trying to find something else to say so that I found something the other day and I hadn't said it in the, I've been working on these jokes for a few months, but I hadn't said it in the joke, and it was about peanut allergies. And then I remembered a joke that had failed for a long time about a classmate of mine who had a peanut allergy. Because the idea now is I've heard a number of middle-aged comedians saying that there were no peanut allergies when we were growing up, and I can refute that. That's just not true. So yeah, I found that while trying to try and make a joke on the Conan show a little more dense, because I have 5 minutes and I can say a lot of funny things during that time. It's not a one-man show where I'm trying to have peaks and valleys. I just want the best advice is to try and, like, internal rhymes. You know about those with rappers and poets where there's a rhyme on the way to the rhyme, and there can be jokes on the way to the punchline. There should be.
So I think in a lot of times those start off as riffs. You know what your punchline is, but you see kind of a reaction in the crowd from some word or some expression you use, and you go a little deeper there. You riff,
right?
And then maybe it gets incorporated into the joke.
Yes, like in the abbreviations joke, I say rogues, fits, misfits, and ne'er-do-wells, which is a really fun expression that's sort of a cliche.
How much do well?
Yeah, how often do well? Ne'er. And that was just something that I wrote down, and it would have been fine had I not called attention to it, but it's a great thing you can unpack. And it was very easy. It took 2 minutes, and then trying it on stage, and the audience loved it.
Well, you said something really interesting when you were describing how you're putting together this Conan set, this upcoming Conan set. You were trying to figure out what do you want to say.
Yeah.
Now, you know, I see comedians here all day, you know, all night long, every day.
Yeah.
And you can see, and this is no criticism to them because the crowd enjoys it no matter what, but you can see a lot of people are looking for premise, punchline, and they're not really thinking that. I could tell they're not thinking ever the phrase, what do I really want to say here? So what does that actually mean? Because I think that is what separates out, you know, a certain level of comedian from other comedians. It's just thinking that sentence while writing a joke.
Yeah, I mean, that's high level stuff. I don't think I really thought about that until recently. I would say that since the beginning, thank goodness, I've always had a certain ethos and aesthetic requirements to the jokes that have made me stand out in certain ways, and that I wanted to be original, and I wanted to be a comedian that I would want to see. But for this particular Conan appearance, I want to refute the idea that millennials are soft, entitled, and lazy, because I it was my tip today, watch the other comedians on your shows, and I watch a lot of the comedians on my shows, and I just keep seeing middle-aged and older comedians dumping on millennials. And even if it were true, it would be something that I would say, well, there are plenty of people covering this subject. It's my feeling on topical humor. It's like, yeah, I could go up there and say some funny things about the president and current events, but there are, I think, 4 TV shows that cover it every day, and they have a team of writers, and it's a very difficult field. It's never been more competitive, and to stand out, it really helps if you're talking about something that nobody's talking about.
And that, of course, I've by been definition,
rewarded,
that's hard.
I've been rewarded so greatly by being quirky. Abbreviations and role play are the two things I'm known by far, and I've done hours and hours of material.
Grapefruit,
and those two,
cookies,
yeah, okay.
Pepsi.
Yeah, right, right. But grapefruit and
Karate Kid.
Yeah,
masterpiece.
I guess so.
Donald
right.
Trump.
Yes, but there. But
Donald
but
Trump when he was
nothing,
just a billionaire.
Nothing is even close to abbreviations and role
right.
play. Right. Yeah.
Oh, the Karate Kid and the Donald Trump one. I've played for a lot of people. Many years ago, but this has nothing to do with the presidency. The Donald Trump versus Bill Gates.
Yeah.
Like, you know, when Bill Gates...
Yeah, this was way before the presidency. Yeah.
Yeah. What's up, Trump?
Yes. And I was looking at some notes, and there was pages and pages of dialogue between those two that I had written and tried out or just felt that it sounded too written or too wordy and It didn't stick because it could have gone on much longer, but it was the main thing that I wish I had kept in there because it didn't always get laughs and it was a little bit vulgar. Was that Trump tried to argue with Bill Gates that he was more impressive because of his prowess with women, and so I took that out because it got a little bit too long, but I wish I had kept that in because that would seem prescient. Yeah.
But it's interesting though. I mean, I don't know what it would have been like with that joke, but I loved the structure of that joke, which is that, you know, and I encourage people to Google it. It's Gary Goldman, Bill Gates, Donald Trump. And just the idea that the whole premise being that Bill Gates can be condescending to Donald Trump.
Yeah.
And it starts off with this whole kind of almost definition of the status hierarchy
right,
you know, billionaires
yeah.
find themselves in
yeah.
and your own relationship to that. And then Bill Gates sort of being almost this savior by being condescending to Trump.
Yes.
It's just hilarious. And then what made it funny is then you're doing something you don't normally do, but it's almost like you're doing an impression because you're Bill Gates
right,
talking
yeah.
down to Trump.
In my voice. But the thing was is that I was trying to remember why I was so mean to Donald Trump before he was president, really. But it was that I despised him because of the birther situation and also the You're Fired, that show. I thought
yeah.
that was a cruel, mean show. And I just have a general aversion to reality TV, but that one especially was just appealing to all the basest instincts. And I will say this, and this will be an eventual tip that I'll put out there, that joke started as a two or three sentence thing about the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and it was not very original in that it was Bill Gates having an argument with his wife over why his name was first, and he was putting it in her place, and I just thought it wasn't very feminist at all, and it was objectionable to me, but it got me to talk about Bill Gates on stage, and led me to talk about his absurd wealth. At the time,
but
yeah.
with Donald Trump,
so it was like scaffolding
as the foil almost instead
yeah.
of
but that
Melinda
was
Gates
months,
or you
months after starting the joke did Donald Trump become the foil
because I mean I saw another version maybe not another version maybe it was in the same set I don't know
yeah
because on YouTube but where one thing Bill Gates won't know is the great feeling it is to find a $20 bill
yes,
in your pocket
yeah. Yeah.
So I don't know if that was in the
yeah.
same set or was it
no,
a different...
No, it was in the same set, yeah. Mm. That I in some ways was just as happy as Bill Gates because of certain things, yeah.
And then I always want to get weave back into the Goldman tips, but then there's something about that joke when so you find a $20 bill in your pocket and you start by saying this is something Bill Gates will never experience, this kind of joy, and you say, my plans changed.
Oh yeah, yeah, like, yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, and you said, you know, you went to Chipotle, but you didn't just say Chipotle, you said Chipotle Mexican Grill.
Oh, yeah.
And so I thought it was funny you added Mexican Grill.
Oh,
everyone just says Chipotle.
Yes.
Why'd you add the words? Just because it's like there's funnier. An absurdity to it.
It's specific and it's the truth and it's funny. And it's also, it makes me kind of a character, like who talks this way?
Yeah.
Who says Chipotle Mexican Grill? It's obnoxious.
And then there are so many good lines in that joke too. I'm just being like a fanboy on this podcast here. But there's so many good jokes and there's so many lines where, like you say, when first off, you're going to treat your friend baller. And everyone laughs at that. And then later...
I regret saying baller.
Hmm?
I regret saying baller.
No, it was funny. Why?
Because it's... Not to mention that it's cultural appropriation. It's also any middle-aged white man can get a laugh by using... Ebonics or African American slang, and as much as I enjoyed the Crazy Rich Asians, I felt that I didn't approve of the characters who used African American slang and mannerisms to get laughs, because it was minstrelly. It was objectionable, and it really bothered me. And I loved the movie, and the performers were great. But I cringe now when I look back and remember that I would use expressions like that, because it's too easy. It's really easy.
Okay, well, hold on to that thought, because I want to get to easy versus not easy, because you're right. I think a lot of comedians stunt their growth almost by sticking to easy, because they know that's what gets them back at the clubs over and over and over again.
Yes.
And I can see from my perspective, both as a, you know, performer and as a club owner, that it caps careers.
Oh yeah.
Like it puts a ceiling on careers, and they
Absolutely.
Don't realize it, and you can't tell them either.
No.
So but there's other things in that joke too, like you know, for a while you're talking about how you couldn't afford the guacamole, but now with the extra $20, you're gonna go all out.
Yes.
And you make a point, I forget the exact words now, but you make a point of saying, you know, I'll take care of Gary Goldman's finances. You know,
she tells me that it's $2 extra. I said, why don't you let Gary Goldman worry about Gary Goldman? And that was something that I had heard. Somebody saw Larry Bird the night before a playoff game drunk. And the person said to him, hey, don't you have a playoff game in like 9 hours? And he said, why don't you let Larry Bird worry about Larry Bird? And it was one of the greatest stories I ever heard. And I thought it would be so obnoxious for me to say that to a Chipotle person over $2.
But then as a further follow on to that joke, or, you know, you said, I'm Gary Goldman.
Yes, that's the point. Larry Bird could say Larry Bird, but Gary Goldman, the people don't even remember who I am halfway through the set. Yeah.
So it was just funny. But and that, I guess, you know, you're speaking a little bit to your truth, which is that, you know, a comedian struggles all the time with you know, money before breakout
success. Oh my gosh. Well, I've had sort of a few situations where I was pretty well off for me. Mm-hmm. Because of development deals and tours, and then inevitably, or I won't say inevitably, knock on wood, this time I won't blow it, or next time I won't blow it, but I bought a house and it went under, and because of contractors and things like that, and I became broke.
Why would abbreviators have a problem with you?
Yes. Oh my gosh. And yeah, so the one redemption of that period was that I had this thing that people really could relate to about being broke. That's most of America. And I remember a comedian coming up to me after seeing me perform the $20 joke, and he's enormously successful and internationally famous and so wealthy. And he said, I was thinking that I would love to have done that joke, but I'd never get excited over finding $20. And I thought to myself, because I don't have much respect for the guy, I thought to myself, I wouldn't trade my act for your money.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
And you know, it's interesting to see.
I don't think he meant to be condescending, but I'm very sensitive, and also it was rude, I thought.
But he's basically complaining about himself, though.
Kind of, yeah.
So,
yeah. It was a combination. Yeah, I'm probably misinterpreting it.
I mean, I'm always wondering.
Or maybe he was just trying to be funny, but I'm incredibly sensitive. Like, my mom said to me that I'm like a different person now, that I'm feeling well, and it's stuck with me for 24 hours. I'm like, I'm the same person. I'm just not sick. I was offended by that. What do you make of that?
Well, I think she's trying to say, you know, whatever you're doing, whether it's medical or exercise or other things you're doing, is positive. She's giving you encouragement. She didn't mean anything negative at all. she didn't say, "Boy, you were a shithead before, and now you're
that's
great."
That's how I took it. That's how I took it.
She loves you and is saying, "Please, Gary, stay on the path that you're on."
Yeah. Oh, that's a much healthier way to interpret that.
That's funny, though, that you wouldn't automatically interpret it that way, but that could be based on your relationship with your mom and the whole thing.
Yeah.
So there's got to be a bit in there somewhere.
Yeah, of course.
So, but it's interesting because I know I keep wanting to get to the Goleman tips, but everything you're saying leads to something else.
These are all tips, right?
but like, you know, in terms of having money and not being able to say the $20 joke, you look at how a guy like, let's say, Louis C.K. or even Dave Chappelle, how they deal with, you know, the fact that it's clear, and Chris Rock too, it's clear they have money now, right? Everybody knows exactly how much money they
have.
Right,
yeah.
And Louis C.K., he did it very intelligently in one special. Maybe it was hilarious. He said, I was flying first class on American Airlines. I got upgrade. I had a bunch of, fuck it. I always fly American Airlines. Everything you guys do, I do better. it's not going to last forever. It's only going to last a few years, then it'll be over, which he turned out to be professionally correct on.
Oh, my word.
But that's how, that was an interesting way for him to
terrific
to deal
way.
With it.
Yes. Brilliant.
So, because then he gets the money issue out of the way, and then he can keep doing his jokes.
Yeah.
And Dave Chappelle, it seems like he just goes right into it and says, I'm rich now. Like, deal with it. I have different problems than you, but we all could still relate.
Yeah.
So it's just interesting to see how different people do it.
Yeah.
Because I think it is a challenge because the everyman lives paycheck to paycheck.
Right.
And so if you're trying to, of course, be a comedian to as large an audience as possible, how do you deal with things that are different than the normal person? But just by definition, being a comedian, you don't have a 9-to-5 job.
Right.
So you're different from 100 million other Americans.
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter whether it's rich or whether you're a comedian or whether you live in New York City, you're still going to be different from most of the audience you want to reach.
Yes. But do you think, this just occurred to me that because we've seen a lot of comedians over the years, I'll just put out a theory. We've seen a lot of comedians over the years who've gotten rich, and then their stand-up has not been as good as it was before they were rich. But my theory is that they started doing less comedy after they got rich, and that's why their stand-up isn't as good. They didn't feel the need to go up every night and do shows in front of 12 strangers or 50 people or whatever, and so they just, by not using their tools and their craft, they just fell off.
So I think that, I mean, you would know better than me, but I think what you're referring to is maybe that they don't go on stage as much, and clearly having a lot of stage time is important for, even if you write down the jokes, just seeing what the audience responds to, riffing and incorporating those into your jokes.
Yes.
And just getting better at presence on the stage.
Oh my
important.
Gosh, yes.
But I think there's something else too, which is that if you, I see this very much, let's say even, and again, I'm not anywhere, right? I'm a tiny baby at this. This is maybe my fourth or fifth year doing it. But if I invite all my friends to the audience, or people who know me from my other lives, like books and things like that, my readers who have been following me for 20 years, I can destroy.
Yeah.
But if I'm going up into a room full of strangers, it's much more difficult. It's a much more of a challenge.
Sure.
And the problem with, like, let's say I'll just use as an example. I'm not saying anything good or bad. Like, I enjoy this person very much, but like Seinfeld, he just walks on the stage mm-hmm. and everyone loves him, and they also love the experience. They're thinking to themselves, "I'm seeing Jerry Seinfeld
yes,
right in front of
yes,
me."
Yes, yes.
So he claims that only buys him 45 seconds.
It only buys me 4 or 5 minutes. But think of the audience you've cultivated, Jerry.
Yeah, that's the thing. Is that
they're all huge fans of Seinfeld,
right?
The show. That's a great group. You would want to, if you were on Facebook, you would try to get people to come to your show that were fans of Seinfeld, because they have kind of a smart look at comedy, and they appreciate a certain type of clean humor, but personal and relatable. And you're not attracting people who are fans of something else, or yeah. metalheads, or whatever.
And you know, almost every comedian I've spoken to on the podcast has expressed the importance of likability.
Uh-huh.
You know, almost more important than humor, because if they don't like you, then they're not going to laugh, even if you're funny.
Yeah.
But comedians like a Seinfeld or any of these big comedians, Dave Chappelle is a great example. People like him the second he's on stage. They're paying already $300 for
right,
tickets at
yeah.
New York City Music
yes,
Hall.
Yes, that's
so
true.
So it's a cognitive bias that they have
yes,
to like them.
That's so true.
So
yeah.
that could make them not know anymore the challenge of doing comedy to a group of strangers. Because that in itself is a big skill. How do I do comedy to a room of 60 people that don't know who I am at all?
Yes.
And three of them are Swedish, so they're never going to laugh.
Yes.
So, you know, there's right. all sorts of things. So I think that could be too.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's whether they, because Chappelle still probably goes up a lot when he's around places, but
yeah,
everybody
sure.
likes him automatically.
Yeah. Yeah.
And maybe they didn't 25 years ago.
Right.
Because they didn't know who he was.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That just could be an addition to your theory, is that the likability almost damages how they're looking. They get skewed by it if it's many years.
Right. I wonder. I also wonder whether they're getting a true read of their jokes, because the audience is so primed and things like
right.
that. That might be an issue as well.
So it's harder yeah. for them to look at the video and say, people didn't laugh at this, because they were just laughing because, oh
yeah.
my God, it's Jerry Seinfeld.
Right.
So
yeah.
you don't know if they're laughing yeah. at the joke or not.
Right, yeah.
And it's going to be interesting how you deal with that, because I feel you're known. You're definitely known among
it's getting easier.
Comedy fans.
Yeah.
Right?
It's getting easier. I'm performing more and more in front of people who are there just to see me.
And when, yeah, because I
yeah.
see whenever you're on tour, everybody from that town like starts tweeting up like,
yeah.
oh, Gary Goldman, you're
yeah, it's very neat. Yeah.
And like, what's the economics of that? Like, let's say you go to St. Louis and you're performing at a club, I don't know, 500 people, 800, how many people show up at a typical?
I would say wherever I go, I can get 1,500 people or so to see me.
1,500 is
yeah.
a lot. That
yeah.
means a lot of people know who you are.
Yeah.
Because if those people make plans
yeah. right.
to
yeah.
show up to see you
yeah.
as opposed to anything else they could do in St. Louis, that means
right.
they know you. They know who
yeah.
you are. And
yeah.
there are only a percentage of the people who really know you but couldn't make it that night.
Yes.
So and then what's the economics? Like they buy, let's say they buy a ticket for $100.
Oh, no, I don't sell tickets for $100.
$50?
No, less than
when
that.
When I saw Dave Chappelle, I paid $300.
No, I think I've limited to like maybe $30 or $35 and sometimes lower than that. So,
and
yeah.
And what is that? You split the door somehow? Or?
I don't want to get into that, but yes, for the most part, there's yeah, that's usually the case
right.
at this point. But there was a time when I would go in for $1,500 for the entire weekend, and no matter how many tickets I sold, I didn't get any more than $1,500. So I'm very grateful that I'm at a place. And I really think I'm not that much better of a comedian. I'm better, but I'm not that much better of a comedian now than I was when I was getting paid $1,000, and glad to get it. And so that, I think, was part of the subconscious decision to start sharing these tips.
Well, by the way, the first tip got like 30 likes on Twitter. The last one gets like 900. So
yeah.
just 20 days later, they're picking up a huge amount of steam. And again, I feel like I'm about to get to them, but I always have
oh, yeah.
more questions. You know, you mentioned about, and this was a tip, like don't do the obvious punchlines.
Yeah.
You know, like if someone can figure out the punchline, you need to go
oh, yeah.
deeper.
Yeah.
And again, I see that a lot, and I think the audience can't always see that But I think the average comedian who goes up at a club is doing a lot of the same, you know, material that everyone else is doing, because it's the quick and easy way to get a laugh. It's, yeah, it's harder to go deeper. But it's hard to also find these areas where, you know, that no one's covered before. Like, again, you take Louis C.K., almost any topic you could tell me, I could come up with a Louis C.K. joke he's done. He's done every topic.
Yeah, that's interesting.
So what do you, and now particularly as you're, I guess one direction to go is, again, mining life's experiences.
Yeah.
But like, what? How do you tackle this issue? Like, if you were going to make a I don't know, you've mentioned quite a bit, you don't want to repeat the same jokes that white middle-aged comedians are making.
Yeah.
Like, how do you then find, you know, what they're not talking about,
well,
or figure it out?
I think one thing that occurred to me when we were talking about what's the audience going to think is the punchline. If they can guess your punchline, then you're not going to get a laugh. But hopefully you'll get to a point where, and this is my aspiration, where the comedians won't know where you're going with this, where they won't be able to predict your punchline, and surprise is such a great, a crucial element in comedy. So if the audience is about to yell out the punchline, or in some cases I've seen audience members yell out punchlines of comedians before they even get to it, it's like you're finished. And then so I think getting specific and being, I read this quote, and I put it up next to my bed, from Maya Angelou. You can't run out of creativity. The more you use, the more you have. And my fear for so long was that let me think how to put this. All right, so I remember when I first did a joke about Netflix. I was like the only comedian who was doing jokes about Netflix. And then I saw another comedian do a joke about Netflix, and I was like, damn it, there goes my Netflix joke. And I think that kind of attitude was limiting. It's saying to your brain subconsciously, yeah, you can't come up with new jokes. You can't come up with new ideas. So you better hold on to and hoard every idea you ever came up with, because it's so hard for you to generate ideas. And that quote from Maya Angelou really, I think, freed me up, at least subconsciously, to say, like, I used to have a joke about Uber, and then I noticed over the past year or so, every comedian who was going on before me had a joke about Uber. And at first I was like, ah, man, I'm not going to be able to do that Uber joke anymore. And then I thought, well, that's good. Let them do their Uber jokes, and I'll write a joke about anesthesia or something. I don't know what I'll write about, but it'll be something that won't be the Uber joke.
But like a lot of, let's say, you know, the comedians who have Netflix specials, they're taking all the, not taking, but they're using the topics they know everyone's experienced. So like, for instance, being broke or abortion or Trump,
right,
or I don't know, whatever the hot topics are that day. It really is sort of hard to find that line that every man is going to sort of understand or relate to the joke, and yet you still have your brand of uniqueness in it.
Right. I think it comes back to one of the tips was to read Self-Reliance by Emerson, and if you don't have it in your head right now, the main thing to me that I got from that was that the specific is universal. So you can be very, very specific and personal, and people will get it.
Do you think now that you're, I mean, you said earlier about your fees and tours, that you feel like you're not necessarily a better comedian than you were then, except then
I'm not this much better.
But I would disagree on the one hand, in that then you were doing the abbreviated states, which obviously is so many people have commented that's like the greatest joke of all time. but now you're mining your personal depths, and that's infinite.
Right.
So for everybody.
Right.
So, and that's really where but I think that's a different kind of challenge. Like, as opposed to just being kind of ludicrous and absurd and just almost looking at it like a Rubik's Cube puzzle you're trying to put together, it's hard to take biography and insert punchlines into it. You know, if you were giving a TED talk, there wouldn't be punchlines every 15 seconds.
Right. But it's actually how I started off in jokes. My earliest jokes were biographical exaggerations of my childhood, and in some ways I've come back to that a little bit, because there was, moving back into my childhood bedroom, there was a lot of time for reflection. I wasn't able to watch TV, and I wasn't able to read. I mean, I had a TV and I could watch it. I had no interest. There was nothing on TV that TV was either boring or would remind me of what a failure I was, that I wasn't on something. And so I just had a lot of time to think in a bedroom that really hadn't changed much since I lived in it as an adolescent.
And so, okay, so take that experience, right?
Yeah.
How would you think about that experience specifically? And if you were to start to put a punchline into it, because that, of course, is, you know, you say the specific is universal. So that's very specific. The average 45-year-old out there hasn't moved back into his childhood room.
Right.
But there's something universal about it, in that every 45-year-old man is scared of that.
Yes.
So there is something universal in there.
Or know somebody, has a relative.
It's not exactly that,
especially nowadays, it's not that uncommon.
And just fear in general.
Yes, certainly.
And so if you were to think about that and to say, because obviously on the one hand, it was a sad time in your life, but if you were to say to yourself, okay, I'm gonna try to figure out where the punchline goes, and I only have 15 seconds. I'm just making that up.
Yeah.
That's considered the timeline. So how would you start to think about that in terms of writing a joke, if you were to take that experience?
I mean, for me, sometimes there are specific anecdotes. The time I was taking out my laundry and folding it, and a pair of my mother's underwear was stuck to one of my sweat-wicking running shirts, and I held it up and I said to her, I said, "Is this yours or mine?" And so I never did that on stage, but it made her laugh hysterically. So that was a long setup to that joke, right? I had to be that age to be in a situation where I'm folding my own laundry, and then have that thought. So yeah, and also it's really uncomfortable and awkward and embarrassing.
Right, and so again, the average person doesn't experience that, right? Because
right,
by the time they're old enough to fold laundry, which by the way is an interesting metric for age, old enough to fold laundry. So there's something there. And then to have that experience, the universality of that is awkwardness.
Yes.
And everyone's done something awkward, whether it was with their daughter or their mother or whatever.
Yes.
I don't want to sound creepy there with the daughter.
Right. But there's this other side of it, in that, like, I was thinking about this last night, just thinking about how lucky I am. If a really nebbishy, broken down guy was talking about moving back in with his mother, and he wasn't dressed in a certain way and he had a certain posture, it might be sad and so pathetic that you would feel sorry for laughing. But because I have sort of an upbeat smile and posture, people say, "Oh, he's over it. He's out of it. There's some distance, and let's have fun with this guy."
As opposed to if I were to move back.
You would have no problem with that either. But I can't think of anybody. But it's just like some people are. There is a lot of luck, and I have a lot of survivor's guilt over my position in comedy, which isn't even that fantastic, but it's better than a lot of guys who are more talented than me have. So
Yeah. I don't know. You're always very self-deprecating, but now I'll hit some of the tips because they are so good and I've been following. What was it? Do you have any time constraints?
I have about 15 minutes left, if that's okay.
Yeah, 15 minutes left. All right. Record every set. Super important. And we were saying before the podcast, you gave me that advice a year and a half ago, and it's been amazing for me. Yes. It's like the best piece of advice I've ever gotten.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Yeah. It's like having a sort of a gold mine in your home that you can. I mean, I have 25 years building up to this, so I can look into notebooks and listen to old recordings and find things, and it's like mining for, I won't say gold, silver, but yeah, it's very helpful in finding jokes and also figuring out where you went wrong or where you need to sort of do try to replicate what you did, yeah.
And also, and this is related to another tip, taking out the ums and the ahs.
Oh, yes.
You can see where you do it, so you can practice saying the joke in your home and just doing it because you have to take out the ums and the ahs and decrease the words. Like maybe you could see there was like one riff you did that didn't quite work or some line that you threw in to build up to the joke that you realize later you didn't need.
Yeah.
So it's valuable for a lot of like, because you give all sorts of tips about taking out words because you even just said about the setup to the folding your mom's laundry. You basically use too many words to get to the laugh, and you mentioned the Goldman tips, you know, just to essentially get to the laugh quickly.
Yeah.
Write out a favorite. This is January 2nd. Write out a favorite joke, word for word, one sentence at a time. After completing each sentence, analyze each word. Why does it work? How do the syllables of the words create rhythm? How do the sentences build to the punchline? What's the grammar of comedy? And I'll ask you about this tip in a second, but you mentioned when we were doing the last podcast about the abbreviated states joke, I would ask you about each word and you would say, it has got a K sound, so it's good to end the sentence with a K sound. So you really think about all of these things.
Yes.
And that can only happen from writing it down.
Yes.
So, but what is the grammar of comedy?
A lot of times you skip certain words and sometimes you use contractions, sometimes you don't use contractions, and sometimes you mumble the tail end of a word when it's clear that they know exactly which word you're talking about and they don't need the entire word. The timing dictates that you say this punchline quickly. It's just at this time it's all feel. And I heard this interview with a man, or read an interview with a man who spent years cutting salmon, the fish, down to pieces for food. And he said he could tell by the sound that the salmon made when he slapped it on the counter where he was going to have to make his cuts because he's been doing it so long. And I have a sixth sense with the audience where I know exactly where to drop the punchline and where to go a little bit faster, but it's being on stage 400 times a year for 25 years.
You know, and it reminds me of the set I saw you do in December 2017 at the Comedy Cellar where your pace was so slow.
Oh, yeah.
And you would say these quotes. I don't know if you remember it. Like you had two or three quotes you were saying, like from other people. I've never seen that in a set, and it was just funny, but it also was interesting.
Like, yeah. Well, the thing is that the audience, I'll go as slow as the audience will let me. Yeah.
It was an interesting lineup because I remember specifically there were about three comedians. You were one of them who were slow paced, and two comedians who were really fast. And the fast guys were getting a lot of laughs, but I couldn't remember a single thing afterwards. And you were probably the slowest, and I could at the time I could clearly remember like the whole set.
It was I mean, part of it is also at that point my brain wasn't probably firing on all cylinders, so I may have been slowed down by that. But it is a technique and a style I employ more and more. And I listen to old sets and I cringe because I go so fast. But the material isn't that great. So you wanna get it out there as quickly as possible before people realize it's not funny.
Do you think you also did that because you were afraid of silences if the material wasn't
Oh,
great?
Yes, of course.
So you would skip the silence?
Yes. Hmm. Yes.
How do you deal with silence now?
Well, I have such confidence in what I'm going to tell you soon that it doesn't matter what's going on now. I can dig a really deep hole, and the punchline to what I'm getting to is so strong that it can overcome that. But again, this is beyond graduate level. This is PhD comedy, really. Yeah, I wouldn't have been able to say that about myself even 4 or 5 years ago.
But I think the purpose of these tips is to not just say what you know, but also to kind of, you know, there's always that so-called 10,000-hour rule of mastery.
Yeah.
But to some extent, you know, in every generation, the 10,000 hours is, you know, sort of textually different. Like, you know, tennis players now are like all bulked up.
Right.
Whereas when John McEnroe was around, they obviously weren't.
Right.
So I get the idea of these tips is to some extent help current comedians skip some of those 25 years. Now, it might be 25 years from now, it might be that this is because you need a whole new set of skills now. You just tennis players
That's
did
true.
20 years later.
Yeah.
But I imagine some of these tips are here, like record every set so you don't have to wait 7 years doing open mics or whatever. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, some people have said to me, why are you giving these things away? And part of the reason is that hardly anybody is going to use them, and the people who will use them deserve them.
Well,
because I would have told them if they had just sat down with me after the show. And there was this other thing that I was thinking was that I had this plan where I was going to go on Saturdays when I was in a town, and Saturday day before the show, I would give a 2-hour lecture called Everything I Know About Comedy. And then I thought, I need that time to prepare for the show, so I really don't want to do that. But I remember there was a comedian who used to charge people to do a class like that, and he would watch them and give them tips and everything like that. And I thought it was so crappy to charge comedians who are broke. It would be in, like, it's not New York where there are some comedians who have a lot of money. It would be in the local places. So unless they're they don't have $200 or $300 to give to some guy to judge them. I didn't like that.
Also, you know, it's an interesting thing about free, right? Nothing is actually free. So everything is a transaction. So when you're giving these tweets away for free, what is ostensibly for free, you have to take a step back and think, what's the actual product? And the actual product is your reader, because what you're doing is you're essentially buying audience. and I don't say this in a negative way. That almost sounds capitalistic and negative.
Right.
But you look at how it builds steam. It's one way of building steam by giving something for free. The readers themselves, because you're not selling something that they're paying for, they become the product. And in a I'm putting it in a crass way, but I don't mean to sound that way, but and it'll work. Because you're giving value, you're delivering value, so you're getting value back. You always get back the value you give, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I mean, I think that what I've told people I'm getting out of it is that it holds me accountable. In that, one of the things I don't know if everybody's like this, but I just despise hypocrisy, and I think it would be so hypocritical if I was giving these tips and then not abiding by them and not writing. And
which
and
is so which is like me, in your tip 5A.
Yeah, it holds me. Yeah, it holds me accountable. Yeah.
So that's your tip 5A is tweet a series of bombastic writing tips so that if you don't write every single day, you'll feel like a hypocrite and a charlatan. Let me see if I could find, you know, some ones I want you to ask you about. All of them I want to ask you about, but I know. And you've talked about this already, which is cannibalize your act, go through your joke inventory, maybe from years ago, and relocate some jokes or pieces of jokes. But you also mentioned in the Chipotle joke, how you mind something Larry Bird said. So you know, let Larry Bird worry about Larry Bird.
Yeah.
Which is very funny.
Yeah.
And when would you mind like, let's say, and I noticed a response to this one, somebody was looking through Mitch Hedberg's notebooks and finding material
for potential jokes. Yeah.
So when would you say it's okay to look at what another comedian's doing, not stealing, but saying, okay, there's a germ of something here. I can maybe go in a different direction with it.
Oh, never.
Never.
Yeah, I don't think that's a good idea. I mean, the thing is that nobody else knew that quote except this college guy that I went to. He's actually passed away, but he was a friend of ours in college, and he told me that story, and I never forgot it. And I was just like, it was the perfect response to that woman, and had so much. I just knew how absurd to get confidence from $20 was, that I felt like Larry Bird.
That, which itself is funny, even though you never mentioned Larry Bird. But
yeah.
Let's see, going through these, some of these. We've talked about a lot of these. Try the same joke with the least amount of words you could possibly imagine saying it with, which again requires...
That was Mike Birbiglia, I think, who guest tweeted that.
Guest tip from a legend.
Yes.
And he's really good, actually.
Oh, he's amazing.
And what he's specifically good at is telling a story that's filled with punchlines.
Funny,
yes. So he could take just a very solid story
that
would almost sound the same without the punchlines, but he's got tons of punchlines and good pacing and so on.
Yeah, he's remarkable.
Oh, and I think he performed that night at the Comedy Cellar. Oh,
okay, cool. Yeah, he's terrific.
Get on stage, writing a joke down is less than 50% of the process. So that's interesting. We live in New York City where there's a billion stages around.
Yeah.
Some people don't. What would you say to people who don't get on stage 7 times a night or even 7 times a week?
Oh, I think you need to get on stage at least 5 times a week to improve. And it's arbitrary, but that was my gauge when I was first starting out. Yeah, that I would need to get on stage 5 times a week, even if it was just in front of, I can remember performing to people sitting at a bar. There was a stage way off in the corner, and luckily they had a wireless microphone, and I just went up to the people who were sitting at the bar and I did my jokes to them, and they must have thought I was insane, but I was convinced that just by saying them out loud, even without any laughter, I would learn the jokes and figure out the pacing and the delivery and all this stuff. So I think that was helpful. Yeah.
It's hard though when someone's beginning to get on stage 7 times a week.
Oh yes. It's hard. I mean, it's easy for me now, but yeah, it's really hard to get on stage 5 times a week when you first start out. And that's why it's fortunate that I started off in Boston, because if I had started off in New York, I don't know whether I would have been able to get on stage even once back then.
You know what I tried a couple of years ago? This is like 2 or 3 years ago. I went on a subway, and every stop,
oh, you told
I went
me
into
about
a different
that.
Car.
Oh my gosh.
And that was
James. That is brave.
It was definitely brave. I don't know if I could do it again.
Oh.
Let me see what else I got here. I don't know, these are all good. Do you mind if I write them down in the article I write about this podcast?
No, I don't mind.
Okay, good.
There are people who have done like documents where they put them all in one document and they've been updating them, but I can't remember what the link was. But
oh, I really like this one. You know that joke, and we talked about
oh,
this
yeah,
briefly.
This is a good one.
You know
one.
That joke you're sick of telling? Write it with space in between each sentence. Add some details, change a word, or unpack an idea. I've done this, and it works really well.
Oh, yes.
Because you find, when you have kind of just the time, you already know something's pretty funny, but not there, and you have the time to think about it, you can find like really absurd or ludicrous stuff to put
totally.
In between lines.
Totally, and you know that you're coming back to a laugh, so you can miss.
Maybe that gives you your confidence about the future when there's a silence on something.
Yes.
So, because you've already known.
Yeah.
So, and then this is interesting. It made me think, be the comedian you wanted to see. Think about the things that you wish someone made jokes about when you sat in the audience. Make a list of topics and ideas that you'd be excited to see someone discuss. You know, that's fascinating. I mean, that's the advice about writing a book. Write the book you wish you had read.
Oh, yeah.
So like, what's an example where you've been able to use that advice?
Well, I think When I was younger, I used to wish somebody would talk about basketball on stage, and I wish somebody would talk about what was the other thing that I was really into when I was first starting out. The Incredible Hulk. I remember, why doesn't anybody ever make fun of the Incredible Hulk? And so I started to try to work on jokes about basketball and the Incredible Hulk, and I wound up writing jokes about football and figure skating and about Karate Kid instead. So that they became things like I was looking for somebody to make jokes about the things that I was obsessed with, and I was obsessed with certain films, and then watch them over and over again, and I realized that I wasn't the only person who was making these observations. I was just at the time the only person who was sort of deconstructing them and making the comments from a person like me. Usually people like me are winners because I'm very...
Well, you make a joke about that, which is that you would expect,
yes,
you know, God has blessed this Jewish person with 6'6", you yes. know, athletic abilities. Yes. You know, yes. you at least think maybe he wouldn't have the neuroses.
Yes.
You'd
yes.
be wrong.
Yes. I'm athletic and physically gifted, but I've approached all these sports from a timid and sensitive place. So when Rocky was drinking the raw eggs, I just knew he was going to get salmonella and cholesterol.
All right. Yeah. Let's say I'll just make this up. Let's say you were obsessed with Schindler's List.
Okay.
How would you? I'm not asking you to come up with a joke on the fly, but how would you start to think about it?
I would think about specific scenes and characters. And I mean, what's the best Schindler's List joke? Louis C.K. about the girl who auditioned for Goodbye Jews.
Yeah,
I
yeah.
And that's it's just the greatest Schindler's List joke. But that would be an interesting one, and it would probably be about just the suffering and the things that I complain about in real life, which is probably a formula that people have used, but just off the top of my head, that's what I would think about. But I would be very specific about the suffering that I'm going through.
So yeah. two quick questions, because I know you have to wrap.
Sure.
Sunday night was the season premiere of Crashing.
Oh yeah.
You've made an appearance on there before.
Yes. Yes.
I think in season two.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But it was really fascinating. Pete Holmes was trying to get past at the Cellar, so he auditions for the real life Esty, who's the booker at the Comedy Cellar. For
yes.
people who don't know, it's the best, it's the biggest and best comedy club in town. And I say this as a co-owner of another comedy club
right,
in town.
Right.
But Esty rejects him, and she says, I didn't get you. You have to answer, who are you? Why are you? Why now? And I thought that was really fascinating, those three questions. And I think with your stuff with the depression coming out, like you're fully answering those questions and combining them with punchlines. And you weren't necessarily doing it before, even though it was, you had the amazing talent to put together the abbreviated states and all those.
Right.
So it's almost like, I don't know. What do you think of her advice? You answer, who are you? Why are you? Why now?
Oh man, I don't know whether I could answer that at any point. Maybe I could now. It seemed very intimidating, but I think those are important, especially now when it's gotten so competitive that we're just going to say, all right, everybody who gets on that stage at the Comedy Cellar is funny. They're really funny, and they're probably going to kill. And then you have to limit it even further and say, okay, just you. Yes, you have to kill, but how are you going to do that? And what are we going to get from that? What are we going to get from that? What are we going to get from you? What are we getting from you that we're not going to get from every other comedian who can kill? Obviously, you're going to kill. We've got plenty of guys who can kill, and we certainly have a lot of young white men who can kill. How are you going to stand out from that? And I remember a tip from Billy Crystal's manager or something like that, that he said that you're not leaving the audience with anything. You're killing, but you're not leaving them with any kind of emotional or visceral thing. And I think he might have been talking about his 700 Sundays, where that was sort of what he had wanted to leave an audience with, something significant like that. Mm. Yeah, not just laughs, but also that. And so, yeah, I think those are three great questions. But I think personally, I would get overwhelmed with those questions and then quit.
And yet you're kind of doing them.
I hope so. Gosh.
So, and then the final question I have, which is related to another.
But also, I will say this, that fame would trump any of those three questions. That if for some reason you were really famous, you could get on stage anywhere you wanted and the audience would go crazy. So there are famous people probably who are not answering those three questions.
Right. I think that's what's happening, maybe to your point earlier about comedians who have, you know, exceeded a certain level.
Yeah.
You know, Tony Rock once came on the podcast and he had this writing advice, which is, think of all these major points in your life. Like, let's say there were five major points in your life, and then make five bullets underneath them, like what happened during those major points, and then come up with a punchline for each.
Oh, that's cool.
Bullet. Yeah. But it's still, I still find it hard. So I tried it.
Yeah.
And I still find it hard to, like, even if something's a critical point, to turn on the punchline mode. Something might be a critical point because it was horrible.
Right.
And it's hard sometimes to...
Yeah.
And I'm a writer for the past 30 years, but not of comedy, but of books and other things.
Sure.
And, you know, and often humorous writing, but it's still... Punchline has a very specific structure, I feel, or maybe I'm just intimidated by it.
I also think that you can be limited by the audiences. So I'm thinking that... If I had to go out and build this set that I have in me now that I'm gonna make for a special about depression and anxiety and failure and hospitalization and all these things, going around to the clubs that I would have available to me in my 20s or even early 30s, trying to put that set together, I would get so discouraged. I would get so discouraged. So you may be putting your five meaningful points in your life and these things that you are looking back on and saying, oh, that was miserable, it was terrifying, or it was exhilarating, and you're not getting the best of audiences to play with them. I think one of the things that's happening now and I sound like somebody who just had a near-death experience, but I really do feel that I Amy will tell you that it was like he was going to be dead in 4 years. That's what she told me. She said, you'll be dead in 4 years. And that woke me up. But so I did have a near-death experience and I was suicidal. But now I'm so grateful because I'm at a time when I can talk about these things, and I don't want to say cultivate because it sounds like I picked and choose. I just happen to attract thoughtful audiences. I don't have a lot of people getting drunk and heckling. I don't have a lot of people wishing I would be dirtier or more brazen. I have a lovely audience to work these things out in front of. So I'm very grateful for that, and the timing couldn't be better.
Well, I think, and just to close off, I think in part that's because, A, your material is always, like, fantastic. I've never seen a single bad joke, or even a joke where I didn't, like, laugh
hundreds,
out loud.
Hundreds of bad jokes.
I'm sure they're out there, but I haven't seen one. And second, you come across as extremely likable as soon as you're on the stage. Like, you have the smile, and everybody wants to see you win. So
it's
helps.
Interesting because I think that I always think I'm likable because I'm funny. They like me because I'm funny, but I don't
but
go
other
in.
Other aspects of likability.
I don't go in right. I don't go in thinking they'll like me. I always think I'll have to win them over, and that's probably a good place to start. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Gary Goldman, definitely. Check him out on Twitter and the hashtag Goldman Tips. When do you think your next special or whatever will come out?
It'll come out in the winter of 2019. I'm shooting it in the summer of of 2019 in New York City. Yeah.
I'm going to that, right?
Oh, that would be so great. Yeah. So,
and then before, look, come on the podcast again.
When I'll come on the next
30 tips.
Yes. So, and also I'll come on and we'll promote too the special.
Absolutely. Yeah. And just to show you how serious I am about that, you know, we've been going back and forth trying to schedule this. I specifically scheduled this for today, and this is the only podcast I'm doing this week because today is my birthday.
Oh, my gosh. So, happy birthday, James. I'm honored.
And thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
My pleasure.
To see you again, and good to see you doing so well.
Thanks, James. I really appreciate all your encouragement and support over the years. Thank you. I mean that. It's been so helpful. Thank you.
Thanks, Gary.
Okay, thanks.